This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
We're really delighted to have Andrew Abasovich with us this evening to talk about his new book, America's War for the Greater Middle East. Now, anyone who knows Andy knows that he doesn't mince words. At the very start of his 450-page work, he makes very clear what he thinks about this ongoing war, now in its fourth decade. He writes, "We have not won. We are not winning it." And then you turn the page, and you're confronted with a very telling map. Those of you who've already picked up the book can turn with me, but I just you may not be able to see it from where you're sitting, but this map is very revealing. It shows the most significant operations and campaigns in which the United States has engaged in what Andy calls the Greater Middle East since 1980. Starting with the failed hostage rescue attempt. And you can see quite strikingly just how much has been going on in this region in the last 35 or so years. Andy has a lot of American mistakes and misjudgments to work with, and he brings to this ambitious and engrossing military history the same background as both an experienced soldier and distinguished scholar that has made so much of his writing so informed and pointed. Robert Kaplan, reviewing the book in the Wall Street Journal, called it Andy's, quote, magnum opus about everything that has been bothering him for decades regarding U.S. foreign policy. Indeed, it's hard to read Andy's critical examination of America's seemingly endless sequence of actions from the Balkans to Pakistan and from Turkey to Somalia, all of which has yielded much destruction, death, and chaos, and little lasting success. It's difficult to survey all this and not come away sharing Andy's deep dismay and agreeing with his broad indictment. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Andrew Abasovich.
Well, I'm grateful for this wonderful turnout. I hope people can hear me in the back. I figure I'm going to talk for somewhere around 20 or 22 minutes. I think we're going until 8 o'clock, and so you should have plenty of time for... can't hear me?
Could you elevate the mic a bit?
Is that better? Well, I'm very grateful for this wonderful turnout. So, some of you know, it's hard work writing a book. The only thing that's harder than writing a book, perhaps apart from giving birth to a child, is getting somebody to notice that you have written a book, particularly in a season when we are preoccupied with the relationship between the size of a male's hand and the length of his sexual organ. So I've been traveling around the country, giving book talks and doing interviews. Everywhere I go, after I give my little pitch about the book, I am asked the following question. So, smart guy, what do you recommend that we should do about ISIS? And in some respects, quite seriously now, the purpose of my book is to suggest that this is the wrong question. My West Point classmate, Rob Goff, is here with me tonight. I'm so pleased that he is with me. Rob and I graduated from West Point back in 1969 and then headed off to Vietnam. Roughly in our junior year at West Point, a winter of 67 into 1968, the country was riveted by a very specific question relating to the Vietnam War. And the question was this: can Khe Sanh hold? And some of you will remember the Khe Sanh was a Marine garrison located in the very northern part of South Vietnam. Khe Sanh was surrounded by at least two North Vietnamese divisions, and the Marines defending the place were greatly outnumbered. Press commentary at the time drew comparisons between Khe Sanh and the Battle of Dien Bien Phu back in 1954. Back in 1954, a besieged and outnumbered French garrison had fallen to the Viet Minh, and the result of that defeat was to end the war and to find the French abandoning French Indochina. Was history about to repeat itself at Khe Sanh? That seemed to be the question of the moment. Well, in the event, the Marines held, and the United States lost the war anyway. So in retrospect, it seems pretty clear that back in 1967 and 1968, we were asking the wrong questions. Rather than focusing on the fate of the garrison at Khe Sanh, the American public should have been asking questions like these. Does the Vietnam War make sense? Is it winnable? If it's not winnable, why are we there? And does no alternative exist to simply pressing on with a policy that shows no sign of success? And I believe today we find ourselves in a comparable situation. What to do about ISIS is a non-trivial question. It's a worthy question. But that question is of far less significance than others that have for too long, at least in my judgment, been ignored. Does waging war across large swaths of the Islamic world make sense? Is that war winnable? If not, why are we there? And for the most powerful country on the planet, is there no alternative? So my book provides an account of this large-scale military enterprise in the greater Middle East and tries to call attention to these more fundamental questions. It suggests that before answering the ISIS question, we should consider how we got to where we are today, which necessarily requires evaluating what prior U.S. military efforts in the region have yielded and at what cost. So my book tells the story of what has become an immense military enterprise, a war for the greater Middle East that began in 1980 and is still underway today. Well, why cite 1980 as the start point for the story? Well, in January of that year, President Jimmy Carter, certainly our least bellicose president in the last half century, used the occasion of his State of the Union address to designate the Persian Gulf a vital U.S. national security interest. In layman's term, in layperson's terms, a place that the United States now considered worth fighting for. This Carter Doctrine, as it came to be known, touched off the process of militarizing U.S. policy, not only in the Persian Gulf, but across much of the Islamic world, eventually landing the United States in a state of what has come to be open-ended war. So the narrative I tell unfolds chronologically. It begins with the failed Iran hostage rescue attempt of 36 years ago this month. It concludes with the now renewed Gulf War, by my count, the fourth Gulf War that we have been involved in. Although, of course, I say the book may conclude, but the war, of course, continues. Good news for me, because it ever comes out in paperback, I'll have the opportunity to add another chapter, no doubt extending the story. Along the way, the book tries to answer four questions. First, what motivated the United States to act as it has? Second, what have the civilians responsible for formulating policy and the soldiers responsible for implementing policy sought to accomplish? Third, regardless of their intentions, what actually ensued. And fourth, with what consequences. In short, the book links aims to actions to outcomes. The central theme of my story can be briefly stated. A nation priding itself in having the world's greatest military, and we do unquestionably have the world's greatest military, a nation priding itself in having the world's greatest military has misused its military power on an epic scale. It's not simply that we have not prevailed, although obviously we have not prevailed. Rather, it is that through a combination of naivete, short-sightedness, and hubris, we have actually made matters worse at very considerable cost to ourselves and arguably at even greater cost to others. Well, what has this war been about? In a narrow sense, it began as a war for oil. Yet even from the outset, much more, in my judgment, was at stake than ensuring access to the cheap gas that fuels the American way of life. From day one, the larger purpose of America's war for the greater Middle East has been to affirm that we are a people to whom limits do not apply. Through a war that now extends well into the 21st century, the United States has sought to validate or affirm the perceived outcome of the 20th century. As enshrined in our collective memory, at least for most of us, as enshrined in our collective memory, that outcome, that the outcome of the 20th century, testifies to American global preeminence, political, military, economic, cultural, and ideological. The outcome of that century also asserts a claim to privileges, above all, to freedom, abundance, and security. These define, in the estimate of most of our fellow citizens, these define our birthright. Yet starting with the Iranian Revolution and the Soviet incursion into Afghanistan, both occurring in 1979, just prior to Carter's statement, events in the greater Middle East had begun to challenge such expectations. And following in their wake came a series of other developments, not least of all the 9/11 attacks, suggesting that the so-called American century might have been a fluke, or worse still, a fiction. The ultimate purpose of our war for the greater Middle East has been to refute any such suspicions. Nominally, the U.S. troops dispatched to invade, occupy, garrison, bomb, or raid various parts of the Islamic world since 1980 have sought to punish the wicked, protect the innocent, and spread liberal values. Their advertised purpose has been to liberate, defend, and deter. Yet their actual purpose has been far more ambitious. The real mission has been to sustain the claims of American exceptionalism that have long since become central to our self-identity, to bring into compliance with American purposes the various revolutionaries, warlords, terrorists, despots, or bad actors of various stripe given to defiance. To employ a term that's very popular in this city, back in 1980, the United States set out in willy-nilly fashion to shape the greater Middle East. Well, given the conditions existing in that part of the world, employing military means to bring the region into conformity with American purposes has resulted in an undertaking that is today breathtaking in scope. Over time, it has found U.S. forces in action everywhere from Iran and Iraq, Lebanon and Libya, Somalia and Sudan, Bosnia and Kosovo, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. The list goes on. Indeed, the list just keeps getting longer. Along the way, we tried overwhelming force and shock and awe. We invaded, occupied, and took a stab at nation building. We experimented with counterinsurgency and counterterrorism, regime change and decapitation, peacekeeping and humanitarian intervention, retaliatory strikes and preventive attack, and even something that the Air Force called air occupation. U.S. forces operated overtly, covertly, and through proxies. Almost certainly, they went places and did things about which the American public today remains completely in the dark. Unfortunately, no administration ever devised a plausible strategy for achieving American aims. Each administration, in turn, simply reacted to situations that it confronted. Nor has any administration made available the means needed to make good on the grandiose ambitions that it entertained. Indeed, on the U.S. side, one of this conflict's abiding qualities, despite its duration, one of this conflict's abiding qualities has been its paltriness, the insignificance of the level of effort made by the United States in pursuit of its objectives. Today, I would argue, the problems besetting the greater Middle East are substantially greater than they were when substantial U.S. forces first began venturing into the region. And indeed, ISIS offers but one example of the results. We may argue, and we may differ, over the underlying causes of these problems. But there is no arguing, I think there can be no arguing, that U.S. efforts to alleviate the dysfunction so much in evidence have failed. Now, to address the situation that the United States faces in the greater Middle East, it seems to me that there really are two plausible approaches to take to the problem. The first approach is to wait things out, insulating yourself from this problem's worst effects while promoting a nonviolent solution from within. This approach requires patience, and it comes with no guarantee of ultimate success. And with all the usual caveats attached, this is the approach that the United States took to waging the Cold War. Wait them out. Promote nonviolent change from within. The second approach, the alternative approach, is more direct. It aims to eliminate the problem through sustained and relentless military action. This approach entails less patience, but it incurs greater near-term sacrifices. And after a certain amount of shilly-shallying, it was this head-on approach that the Union adopted during the Civil War to destroy the Confederacy. In its war for the greater Middle East, I would argue, the United States chose neither to contain nor to crush. Instead, it charted a course midway in between. In effect, it chose aggravation. With politicians and generals too quick to declare victory, and with the American public too quick to throw in the towel when faced with adversity, U.S. forces rarely stayed long enough to finish the job. Instead of intimidating, U.S. military efforts have annoyed, incited, and generally communicated a lack of both competence and resolve. In the ultimate irony, the circumstances ostensibly making the Persian Gulf worth fighting for in the first place have ceased to pertain. If today the American way of life still depends, for better or worse, on having access to plentiful reserves of oil and natural gas, then defending Canada and Venezuela should take precedence over defending Saudi Arabia and Iraq. Even so, shorn of its initial rationale, the war for the greater Middle East continues as if on autopilot. That the ongoing enterprise may someday end, that U.S. troops will finally come home, appears so unlikely as to make that prospect unworthy of discussion. Indeed, here we are in the midst of a presidential campaign, and that subject doesn't even come up. Like the war on drugs and the war on poverty, the war for the greater Middle East has become a fixture in American life. And sadly, we accept it as such. Well, among the factors contributing to the lack of any serious challenge to the war's perpetuation, it seems to me four factors stand out. One is the absence of an anti-war or even anti-interventionist party worthy of the name. The ongoing war has long since acquired a perfidious seal of bipartisan approval. And as such, both of the major parties are equally disinclined to probe too deeply into the war's origins, conduct, or prospects. They're both implicated. A second reason for the war's perpetuation is that politicians aspiring to high office find it more expedient to strike a posture indicating that they support the troops and, by extension, the war, than to question the war's efficacy. So candidates in every election since 1980 have avoided anything like a serious debate with regard to U.S. policy in the Islamic world, and certainly the present presidential campaign offers no exception to that statement. True, a particular military operation or campaign gone awry, like Lebanon back in 1983 or Somalia in 1993 or the occupation of Iraq after 2003, a campaign gone awry might attract brief attention, but never the context in which that campaign occurred. To put it another way, the war for the greater Middle East awaits its Eugene McCarthy or its George McGovern. The third reason for the war's perpetuation, of course, sadly, is that some individuals and institutions actually benefit from an armed conflict that drags on and on. Those benefits are immediate and they are tangible. They come in the form of profits, jobs, and campaign contributions. For the military-industrial complex and its beneficiaries, perpetual war is not necessarily bad news. But finally, there is this. Thus far, at least, Americans themselves appear oblivious to what is occurring. Policymakers having successfully insulated the public from the war's negative effects. In a fundamental sense, we live in a country that is perpetually at war, and yet the war is not our concern. But here's the rub. In the 21st century, the 21st century that we actually live in, the prerequisites of freedom, abundance, and security are changing. Geopolitically, Asia is eclipsing in importance all other regions of the world, apart perhaps from North America itself. The emerging problem set that we confront, coping, for example, with the effects of climate change, the emerging problem set is global and will require a global response. So whether Americans are able to preserve the privileged position to which they are accustomed will depend on how well the United States adapts itself to these fresh circumstances. Amidst such challenges, the afflictions, and they are real afflictions, besetting large portions of the Islamic world will undoubtedly persist. But the relative importance of these afflictions to the United States as determinants of American well-being will diminish. So in this context, the war for the greater Middle East has become a diversion that Americans can ill afford. To fancy at this point that the United States military possesses the capacity to shape the course of events there is an absurdity. And indulging that absurdity further serves chiefly to impede the ability of the United States to attend to concerns that are far more pressing, even as they are largely ignored. Ultimately, the game that really matters will play itself out here at home rather than in far-off places like Iraq or Afghanistan. Whether the United States is able to shape the greater Middle East will matter less than whether it can reshape itself, restoring effectiveness to self-government, providing for sustainable and equitable prosperity, and extracting from a vastly diverse culture something to hold in common of greater moment than shallow digital enthusiasms and the worship of celebrity. Perpetuating the war for the greater Middle East is not enhancing American freedom, abundance, and security. If anything, it is having the opposite effect. One day, the American people may awaken to this reality, and then and only then will the war end. When this awakening will occur is impossible to say, however. For now, sadly, Americans remain deep in slumber. Thank you very much. So I welcome your comments and your questions, and I think what we've been asked to do is to have people come. There's two mics, and so we'll go back and forth. Sir, you leapt up.
Demonstrating
really impressive agility, so we'll let you go first.
Thank you. I'm 91 years old, so that word agility is really a compliment. Thank you. However,
I would challenge him to a push-up contest, but I fear I would lose.
No, sir. First, a compliment. Your speaking style is the most direct and effective and audible that I've heard in years, and that's very unusual for authors.
But that's only because I adjusted the mic.
That's right, yeah. Which I suggested.
You did.
The hearing system's 91 years old, too, okay, you see. Right. So now, I've been around an awful lot of long time, and I've worked on Capitol Hill, and I've worked in a White House, and I remember when I became convinced that the Vietnam War was absolutely unwinnable, roughly around the time of Tet, I think, because it did change the American opinion tremendously.
But there are people waiting in line, so you want to get to your question here pretty quick.
I won't belabor this too much. Thank you, Colonel. What was your rank, by the way?
Professor.
Okay. I won't probe further. But I also came to the conclusion some years ago that the Middle East situation, whether we're talking Israel and Palestine or all these other conflicts, is insoluble for two words, which I did not hear in your talk. One word is Shiite and the other was Sunni. And that conflict, which has gone on for centuries, I don't see ending in the next century at all, certainly not in the lifetime of anybody in this room.
I got it.
Now, oop. There we are.
Okay.
You want to comment on that?
I got it. There's no question. There is a deep-seated, profound religious element aspect to this problem. I do think it's a mistake to reduce the issue to that one explanation. It seems, in a sense, were we able to simplify it to that degree, it might actually be possible then to think creatively about what a response might be. Yes, there's a religious element. Yes. There is the factor of pernicious European imperialism well before the United States became involved in the region in a military way. My next book, not really, but I've always wanted to write a book that blames Great Britain for all the problems besetting the contemporary era. You know, this notion of Roosevelt and Churchill standing arm in arm, sponsoring freedom. I'm tired of it. I'm tired of it. So there's European imperialism. There is the record of U.S. involvement in the region, even before my military narrative, which begins in 1980. The overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran back in 1953, in retrospect, was a catastrophic error on the part of the United States by President Eisenhower, who somebody who, by and large, I admire. So the issue is multifaceted. It's complex. It's confounding. But I would simply say then that what I think was implicit in your question is that I guess that means we should throw up our hands and walk away. That's not the point of my book. The point of the book is to say that to fancy that somehow or other the further use of American military power is going to unravel that complex situation is a fantasy that's not going to happen. So it's incumbent upon us, what we ought to demand from our national security apparatus, is to acknowledge that the ongoing military enterprise has failed, and therefore it's incumbent upon those who conceive of policy to begin to look beyond the war for the greater Middle East and conceive of alternative approaches to policy. And I would insist that alternative approaches exist. It's not simply continue the war or opt for isolationism. There are alternatives. And I dare say that before we adjourn, somebody's going to say, well, what are they? And between now and then, I will try to come up with an answer. Sir.
Thank you for your wonderful presentation, and I want also to express my appreciation for your colleagues and your friends. What you're concluding with is to suggest that it's not just a military turmoil, but one that involves social and economic and religious and other kinds of cultural, I won't say warfare, but you could almost say that. I was only briefly in Vietnam. I liked your analogy, but I came back able to write a line. Vietnam was a firefight in the Cold War, which we won, and ask whether maybe 50 years from now the Middle East war that you describe could take such a role.
I think not, and with all due respect, I don't think the analogy works. Yes, we won the Cold War, but you'll recall that we didn't win the Cold War by invading Poland. The principle, apart from the catastrophic mistake of Vietnam, the principal employment of U.S. military power during the Cold War was to keep it in abeyance, to use it as a vehicle to contain the Soviet Union, to deter the Soviet Union, or more broadly, communist powers from undertaking acts of aggression. Like one of the problems with the war for the greater Middle East is that, particularly in the wake of the Cold War, U.S. policymakers came to a different appreciation of what they believed U.S. military power was good for. And what they concluded was that U.S. military power was kind of an all-purpose instrument that can be employed to bring about change, to force change. I mean, the greatest illustration of that logic, of course, occurs in 2003 when the George W. Bush administration invades Iraq in order to begin what it sees as a longer-term project of transforming large parts of the Islamic world, an effort that, of course, results in catastrophe. So I don't believe that it's likely that 50 years from now we will reach the judgment that you are suggesting. But may I say...
Korea?
May I say that I really hope that 50 years from now, you and I... can meet here to continue this discussion. Yes, sir.
Like you, I'm troubled by the lack of protest against this ongoing war. And I'm your age, so I know about the Vietnam. And one difference between Vietnam and here now is the draft.
This is the I get two questions every time I talk. The Israel question and the draft question.
Yeah.
Somebody's going to ask the Israel question, right?
Not me.
So here's the draft question. Yeah, yeah. And the premise behind the question basically is, if we still had conscription, would that not close the gap between the military and society, engage the American people more directly, give them a stake in this ongoing war, and therefore provide some sort of break on misguided decisions by policymakers? Could be. But we're not going to have conscription.
Right.
It ain't going to happen. I mean, there is zero. I mean, if we polled, I think if we polled the 18-year-olds of the country, how do you feel about conscription? I think it would lose. If we polled the parents of the 18-year-olds, exactly, wouldn't come close. I got a 10-year-old granddaughter. Ask me what I think about conscription. I do not wish to see my granddaughter be conscripted. But the point here is that there's a need, first of all, to recognize the defects in our military system. That is to say that the decision to abandon the tradition of the citizen soldier at the end of Vietnam, instead to have the professional soldier, the regular, now be the foundation of our military policy, that decision yielded consequences that very few people back then anticipated would occur. And we can now see that there are many positive things to say about the existing military system. I mean, there are. But it's time for us to recognize the downside. And I think that apart from conscription, there are at least some policy options that are at least worthy of consideration. One is, could we create material incentives to include more members of the offspring of the middle class and even the offspring of the elite in the military? How would you do that? Well, I mean, the cost of a college education today, Boston University, where I used to teach, I think it's about $55,000 a year. Maybe it's $58,000, tuition, room, and board. That's a lot of change. What if we promised the young 18-year-old young woman, serve 3 years in the military, and we'll give you free 4 years, paid, total, 4 years at Boston? No, ROTC. You serve as an enlisted soldier, and at the conclusion of your 3 years, you get a full ride, everything, to Boston University. That might interest some people. So I think we could create material incentive. But the other thing is, I think it's time for us to have a conversation about the possibility of a program of national service. See that? Everybody, this comes up, everybody my age says, oh, yeah, national service. That's really good. So let's talk about what national service is. National service says all the 18-year-olds in America, 18, 19, whatever, when they come out of high school, each one owes a term of service to country and community, kind of en route to becoming a full-fledged citizen, is that you have to perform some obligatory service. It could be in the military, could be in some new version of the Civilian Conservation Corps, could be working in a vet's hospital, could be working in an old folks' home, broad menu. And all of us, you're not that old, all of the old people think this is a great idea because, of course, they're old. I like the idea because I'm an old person, but I also recognize that there are some real complications. I think the 18-year-old cohort from 1 year to the next is like 3 million people. So we got to have 3 million good things to do, worthy jobs, worth the time of the young person who's going to be spending 2 or 3 years doing that. And now we're going to have to create a bureaucracy to manage the placing and supervision of 3 million people every year. This is not going to be easy. So I think conceptually it's a wonderful idea. I think politically it ought to be the sort of thing that gets discussed when you're talking about electing a president. Alas, it's not. But I wouldn't want to, hand-wave the complications away. Yes, ma'am.
Well, I was going to ask the draft question because you're exactly my age, and my late husband was an anti-war activist. He took me to my first Pentagon demonstration. So I'll ask you the other question. How many times do we have to take Ramadi? The problem in Vietnam, which I remember very well, and the problem we have in Iraq, is that we have no one to turn the country over to. People don't like the government, and the government is corrupt. And so as soon as we leave, Ramadi falls, and we have to take it again. That doesn't make any sense. Well, that's just it. I mean, do we have to occupy the place forever, or what do we do? Because continually taking it, giving it away, and then losing it and having to take it again, that's crazy.
Yes, it is. And so this is the okay, smart guy, what's your alternative strategy question. It's expressed in somewhat different words. And I think the answer to the question is this. So in other words, okay, you don't like the war for the greater Middle East, smart guy. What's the alternative? Three-part proposal, okay? Number one, really got to be realistic about the threat. I mean, raise your hand if you think ISIS poses an existential threat to the United States of America.
No.
One, two.
Two. Starbucks in downtown D.C., that could be pretty easy.
Yeah. Existential threat means the capacity to bring about the fall of the republic. All right. So you raising your hand still? We got two. We have two yeses. Everybody else, I'm assuming, is a no. I'm a no. I mean, ISIS. What do we got now? What we got in ISIS? We got a country that has, an entity that has no air force, no navy, very. Almost a non-existent resource base on which to draw. Basically, no allies. It consists of, round numbers, 25,000 fighters, most of whom are they're vicious killers, most of whom are lightly armed, and they are somewhere in the order of 7,000 miles away from where we are sitting. ISIS, it does not pose an existential threat to the United States of America. Terrorism, more broadly, does not pose an existential threat to the United States of America. It does pose some threat, modest, which we should take seriously. What's the appropriate response to that threat? The appropriate response is to erect effective defenses, that which we did not have on 9/11. Certainly, in the years since, we've made great progress there. But not to be taken for granted. So in my three-part strategy, point number one is make sure that our domestic security agencies are effectively led and properly resourced in order to minimize the likelihood of bad guys 7,000 miles away being able to put together a conspiracy to cause some amount of havoc here in this country. And realistically, we know that those efforts will not be 100% effective all the time. Just as I know, living in Walpole, Massachusetts, a sweet little town, that the police force is unable to guarantee with 100% assurance that there will not be some amount of criminal activity in my town. All I want is that you do a good enough job that I can more or less live a normal life. Step number one, point number one, self-protect. Point number two, ISIS does pose an existential threat to some people. And who would that be? Well, to the state of Iran, to Turkey, to Saudi Arabia, to pathetic little broken Iraq, because ISIS's purpose is to create this new caliphate and erase the state system that the European imperialists created for their own purposes, of course, in the wake of World War I.
Not Iran.
Well, they didn't create Iran. But Iran is still threatened by this caliphate. And so it seems to me that point number two is...
Back to the mic, somebody.
Point number two is recognizing the failure of our military effort, the failure of our effort to bring stability to the region, to recognize that the essence of the problem is one that countries in the region are going to have to solve for themselves. Now, you might say, but gosh, Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, these are countries that get all kinds of gripes with one another, deeply rooted in history and religion and so on. And it seems to me that the creative diplomatic task facing the United States, I'd rather see this than dropping more bombs and sending in more Marines, is to persuade the countries in the region to recognize that they have a transcendent common interest to deal with this proximate threat, and that whatever their other gripes with one another, those gripes for the moment ought to be subordinated to this particularly urgent imperative. And oh, by the way, were they to do so, that is to say, were they to find it possible to collaborate with one another to deal with ISIS, which they could handle without great difficulty, that would then begin to create an opportunity for the United States to begin demilitarizing its own policy in the region. It would start to open a door that would enable us to bring this misguided military effort to an end. That was point number two. Point number three, can you tell that I've done this before? Point number three really gets to what's the real essence, the root of this antagonism directed toward the West that manifests itself in terrorist activity and jihadism and in violent Islamic radicalism. You pick the name. Modernization. Somebody said modernization? Please explain what you mean, sir. Who said modernization? Well, let me finish his sentence. It is modernization in this sense. Is it? And believe me, I am not, absolutely, emphatically not a scholar of Islam. But it does seem pretty evident, and people who know more than I do have said this, is that some people in the Islamic community find it challenging to reconcile faith with modernity, to figure out how to be believers and yet exist in a world which is, in many of its manifestations, deeply secular. So the ultimate solution to the problem is for that reconciliation between faith and modernity to occur. Raise your hand if you think the United States of America can offer instruction for how they should do that.
We can't keep a metro.
Not even the two. One person did. Okay. You're right. We can't any more than we needed people from the Islamic world to offer instruction to the West when Protestants and Catholics were killing one another over our own religious issues. We had to find our own path to reconciliation. They're going to have to do the same. How long is it going to take? Even longer than the gentleman who I'm going to meet in 50 years so that we can resolve our disputes. It's going to take a long, long time. What can we do in the meantime? I think what we can do in the meantime, I'm serious now, I think what we can do in the meantime is to demonstrate by our own behavior that there need not be a contradiction between faith and modernity. That liberal values provide a path to make that reconciliation possible. Now, that gets to how we live our lives as a society, but I think more practical. When I was teaching at BU, I think many campuses these days were flooded with what we euphemistically call international students, meaning kids coming from abroad. And a lot of them are from Asia, And you can tell when they're from Asia because they're always driving Lamborghinis around campus. It's a lot of money over there. But when I was teaching at BU, we were having an increasing number of young people coming from the Gulf states. And without exception, they were immensely bright, interested in getting an education and learning. Quite frankly, more interested than probably most of American students. And I had a sense, which I couldn't empirically demonstrate, I had a sense that when they finished studying at Boston University and went home, they took home impressions of the United States that were more positive than negative. That coming to America and studying in America, participating in social and cultural changes, at least in a modest way, helped to communicate the message that we are not their enemy. And that is one step, I think, toward promoting this appreciation that there is a reconciliation between faith and modernity that will be as possible for people in the Islamic world as it is possible in the West. Now, that's not something that then, you know, within 3 weeks we can say victory. It's something that on the margins and incrementally over time, I would argue, can make a positive difference. Yes, ma'am.
Hello. I speak as an outsider, so I'm not in the we. I would have liked you to touch on two things. One was, I think it was a very enlightening distinction on what the actual purpose was, which is preserving the American exceptionalism. So that was quite honest, and I don't think that's as out there as it is. So I wanted you to actually question not the effectiveness of reaching that objective, but actually the ethical and moral legitimacy of that objective. Why is the American way of life so uncompromisable, and why at all costs on the other countries? The second one I wanted you to raise was from a military scholarship and historical point of view, is to see not only how U.S. reacts, but also how U.S. itself actually creates threats to itself and to others. So, for example, I would consider it an incomplete representation of what is going on in the Middle East, as if something bad happened because of an autarkic regime. We went in, we didn't know what we were doing, U.S. went in, they were not very effective in reaching their goal, and things just kept going bad. I think it's important to notice that U.S. went in, not only they were ineffective and incompetent, but also they actually created additional threats that fed into the failure that proceeded, and that is a moral responsibility.
I paid her to say this, because in fact she's articulating one of the themes of this book that I'm hoping that you will purchase in multiple copies before the evening is over, because you're exactly right. And indeed, I'm not sure if it's implicit or explicit in the argument I make, but one of the points of the exercise is to encourage readers to say, oh, yeah, there has been an American war for the greater Middle East. Not simply one damn thing after another, sort of disconnected, always responding to some new situation, but to appreciate the continuities and to appreciate the effects, usually unanticipated and unintended, but not necessarily less pernicious for that fact. So you're exactly right. I mean, to use the cliche, the dots connect. And indeed, ISIS is a perfect example of that. ISIS would not exist today had the United States not invaded Iraq back in 2003. I mean, that's just simply the way it is, folks. Now, to listen to our presidential candidates who say, elect me and I will destroy ISIS, as if that constitutes some sort of a insight into statecraft, That very notion is it can that can't be said other than by simply ignoring everything that happened. So I'm trying to get people to connect these dots. Okay, and then the first question you said was, please explain to me why Americans embrace this notion of their chosenness, our specialness, that we are God's instrument, that we are supposed to transform the world in our own image. And I need to write a book about that. Well, actually, I don't. Are you a student? Okay. Do you have in stock Reinhold Niebuhr's Irony of American History? Okay. This is a book published in 1952. Reinhold Niebuhr was a theologian, public intellectual, and I believe that The Irony of American History, it's a little book, is the most important book ever written on U.S. foreign policy. And he discusses and warns against the embrace of American exceptionalism. So I can't give you a good answer to your question. Reinhold Niebuhr can. But you might read the introduction to the book because I wrote the introduction. Two more questions. Yes, sir.
I have a see whether this depressing analogy works for you. I just finished a book on the invasion of Afghanistan in 1836 by the British Empire, which was a colossal disaster. And I'm sure the American drones recently flew over the Roman ruins in Palmyra. The fact is, although Americans don't like to admit this, they are an empire.
Absolutely.
And they follow in the steps of the Roman Empire, the British Empire, and have many of the same qualities, the self-reverence, the exceptionalism. I mean, the British were very keen on that. Empires have their dynamics, and they have to keep going and defending their borders. Isn't much of what you're describing in the Middle East the classic behavior of an empire? And empires only change their habits, not when they rethink their position, which is what you're doing, when they simply run out of resources.
I would agree with the proposition that empires cannot learn and cannot adapt. But I would point out that back in 2002, I wrote a book called American Empire, which I think is still in print. Do you have American Empire available in this store?
You're pressing your luck.
No, but
two points. First is you're absolutely correct. That by and large, the American people push back against the notion that we have been an imperial power for all kinds of reasons. We don't want to think of ourselves in comparison to these failed empires of mostly, in more recent times, of European origin. I personally think, and it's true, our empire is different. Our empire is not like the British Empire was.
But it's
not like what the Roman Empire was. But it does seem to me that it's a step toward wisdom and self-understanding to acknowledge that there has been this imperial thrust in U.S. policy, and as I would argue, an imperial thrust really that was renewed by the end of the Cold War and helps explain U.S. behavior over the course of this war for the greater Middle East. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go with you on that one. We are a military empire.
The three of us are in agreement.
Yeah, I mean, it's pathetic. And as someone who's worked with the frontline soldiers and mental health, back to the Vietnam and if the draft came in, I would have to say the upper middle class took care of itself. Its children took care of themselves in the 60s, and now their children and grandchildren are watching the Carcassians. And therefore, they don't have limb or life or mental health invested in this. And coming from an upper middle class background with healthy young nephews, they say, well, I can't go off to war because I have dyslexia. And I say, well, nephew, speaking for someone who has worked in the mental health, we've been sending bipolar diagnoses, manic depression down of coal miners' children. So I would have to say the so-called bourgeois class has to take responsibility to also what is happening here, going around with the big houses with only two kids in the SUV. And I want to just celebrate how you started your presentation about the, and I'm going to throw in a clinical word, the disconnect, the disassociation to what's happening in the rest of the world and what we are doing to human beings as we sit here with this so-called American life. And I couldn't help reflect of the diner up at Chevy Chase Circle with the American Dream post-World War II poster or the American way of life. Who's questioning what is that and at what price? And it breaks my heart as a 50-year-old woman, and I even find friends, former Peace Corps volunteers, have some sense of the difference between Mexico and New Mexico, are also detached. And I would have to say, collectively, this American personality is at a clinical level of a normalization of pathology and so disassociated. And I would say, if this was my client, what's behind this? Why is it so anesthetized that it can't look itself, the client, in the mirror?
So,
it's heartbreaking.
I'll just make the last comment, and that is my last comment is usually I leave people terribly depressed at the end of my presentations, but she has outdone me. All right. Hey, I really enjoy talking to you. I appreciate you coming. I appreciate the questions. If one or two of you would like me to autograph a book, I would be more than happy to do that. But thanks a lot.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.